then when they, and I'm kind of just trying to low key it as much as I can. And as when they take that off and I hear, hey, we need a chest wound or a chest seal. We need some chest seals. I don't know what it was, but I knew chest seals were bad. And so I immediately, that's when my stomach kind of sank. And I said, oh, this is a lot worse than I think it is. 111, 110.
Street Cop. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and we are thankful to have Riley Mouch. Is that how you say it? Mouch?
Mock.
Mock. I know I was going to fuck that up.
That's what it is. Yeah.
But right. Riley comes from quite a story, Street Cop survivor. Crazy incident. Unfortunately, I guess you were the only one that had to suffer the most out of what went down, all the officers that are on scene during this debacle. But we'll let you tell that story. Before we get there, man, first of all, I want to say thanks for coming on and doing the show. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Honored. Appreciate it.
Before we go to the story again, let's go into more of who you are, where you're from, and how you ended up in law enforcement.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Idaho, Pocatello. Lived there for just a few years. I don't remember any of that. Then grew up in Utah, moved down to Utah County, Utah Valley, went through school there, met my wife in high school, actually. We're high school sweethearts. Got married really young, 22 years old. We ended up getting married. We have three kids now, 12, 8, and 4, two boys and a little girl. That little girl she's got my finger wrapped around. So she is everything. So initially when my wife and I, were getting ready to get married, when we were talking about proposing and all that, she said, I'll say yes if you promise me one thing. I said, of course. She said that you won't be a cop. And, I said, you're killing me. 'Cause that's all I ever wanted to do. Growing up, my best friend who lived down the street from me, his dad was a cop. And so having sleepovers over there all the time, seeing him leave for his graveyard shift. And then we'd go on ride-alongs with him. He ended up promoting. He just retired after 34 years. He was the deputy chief of the department down in Provo. And he just retired. And seeing that and being around that at that young age kind of instilled in me the desire. And then it wasn't until I got through high school and I started to see some of my friends kind of slip up, go down different paths. They got into drugs. A couple of them got into it really, really hard. And growing up, having that kind of background of seeing my being around my buddy's dad, having that instilled, and then seeing my friends mess up, it kind of just forged this desire or fire, if you will. I know it's kind of cliche to say, but just to kind of try to stop that at whatever, any cost. And so got older, my wife said she knew I wanted to be a cop. And I told her, you know, I this is what I want to do. And she made me promise not to. So I said, okay. And going back to that desire to, you know, see my friends mess up and that kind of stuff. So my dad, actually in 1977, he was 20 years old. His brother was high. They lived out Podunk Town in Idaho on a farm. The brother was high and was, he was out of his mind, and he ended up taking a shotgun and shooting my dad in the face with it when he was. Shit. Yeah, when he's 20 years old, blew his jaw off, the lower jaw off. Crazy story. He somehow survived. And it was like 13 hours of surgery just to stabilize him. And, you know, he flatlined twice, like crazy story. And he's lived with that pain and that, the repercussions ever since. Guys, my dad's just a the strongest person I know. Like, he's just insane. And how he's just lived with it. And so, sorry, I should have probably started with that. So that, and then seeing my friends get into it, that was the desire. Like, I was like, I want to try to stop these drugs. I want to try to stop these people that are these bad guys, you know, doing these things. That was really important to me. And so that's what really instilled in me of why I wanted to be a cop. And so then made that promise to my wife, said, okay, I won't do it. And so, you know, honestly struggled for a while to find out what I wanted to do. And so I was 25 when a couple of years before that, my buddy had joined the Navy. And so then a couple of years later, I'm 25 and like, I don't have any direction really. I'm kind of bouncing in and out of school, trying to figure out what I want to do. And my buddy kind of convinces me that, you know, hey, getting into the Navy might do something for you. And so oddly enough, my wife agrees. You know, she's like, you won't let me be a cop, but you'll let me join the military. All right, whatever. So I do like a test program. I just do the reserves. And so I do that. I get out of I was gone for like almost a year, come back. And I sit down with my wife and I'm like, I need to be a cop. This is what I'm supposed to do. This is what I want to do. So she agrees. And I start in, I get a job with the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Department at the jail. So I start in corrections. And that's really what started it all. 2014, I started and did almost 2 years there when she told me, again, I sound like a really shitty husband, but she promised me, okay, you can be a cop if you just don't do it in West Valley. And I said, okay, that's fine. Because I didn't really want to do it up in West Valley. West Valley was notorious for, you know, a lot of crime, a lot of just everything. And so, but I had that same best friend that I grew up with, he worked in West Valley. And so he kind of talked to me. He's like, this is the place you want to be. It's fun. It's proactive. It's awesome. So without telling my wife, I applied for West Valley. And one day before I was going to work, when I was working at the jail still, I was leaving in my suit and tie. And she's like, do you have an interview somewhere? And I said, yeah. And she asked me where. And I just said, West Valley, love you. Bye. And I left the house and ignored her calls until I got out of the interview. And ended up getting the job. And I started there in 2016. And then I took a brief, for some reason, sounds like I'm easily influenced by friends. My friend got me to come down to another department. It was a lot slower pace. I was there for like 6 months. It was American Fork here in Utah County. And I decided, you know what, it's not for me. So I went back to West Valley, and that was in 2018. So I've been there, took a little 6 month break, and then have been back, been in West Valley since 2018. So.
Interesting. Your wife, obviously you guys have three children together. She's your high school sweetheart. I'm sure that you care about her tremendously. Where does that come from? Where does her desire to not allow you to be a cop come from? Clearly, there's an underlying anxiety that she has associated with. Is there any way to pinpoint where that comes from? Or she's just like constantly somebody who worries? So I imagine I imagine once you were shot, all her fucking fears came true.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, she's always been like that. She's always just been kind of a worrier, and like she just, anxiety riddled, if you will, bless her heart.
Yeah, sure, dude. But, I mean, do your kids have to suffer the detriment of her anxiety? Because I'm obviously a father of many, and I watch other parents let their anxiety dictate how they parent. And it's a really, this has nothing to do with your wife, but I feel bad for these kids because they're under the watchful eye and constant anxiety of their parents. They're like, don't do that, don't touch that, don't do that, go over here, slow down, don't run, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, guys, you're fucking killing the children from the children. You are literally trying to make them conform to being 48 years old when they're six and they just want to fucking run and climb, and just let them run and climb.
Yeah. Yeah. We balance each other out really well because I am super relaxed, chilled, have that attitude. Kids will be kids. I grew up that way. I grew up with older brothers. She grew up with older sisters.
Ah, there you go.
So, you know, completely different, you know, way of growing up. So, yeah, my brothers and I, we fist fought like all the time, like legitimately punching each other in the face. You know, that's what we did. And so, you know, then she was like, no, we just, the worst we said was like, I hate you. You're not wearing my shirt tomorrow type of thing. And so, you know, bless her heart. She's amazing. She's, and yeah, obviously not to take away from the kind of mom she is, 'cause she's a great mom. She just, it's just like, it's just kind of that thing that, you know, it's just always something in the back of her mind running. Right. So, I think she just was just worried that something would happen to me. I feel that's why she didn't want me to be a cop. She was just worried something would happen to me, worried that she'd be alone, you know, and have to go through life as a widow and those kind of things. She jumped automatically to the worst possibilities, right? Like most of us do. And so I think that's probably what pinpointed it. But, but like I said, she agreed.
I don't want to jump ahead to the end of the story, but you know, how has her disposition changed, or has it stayed the same or gotten worse since the incident?
She's come out way ahead. So it's really allowed her to see the support from the police community, from the department, from, you know, complete strangers. So I think having that knowledge now has allowed her to kind of take it back a little bit and realize that, okay, you know, if the worst comes of this, I can do this. I'll be okay. I can get through this. This was something hard. But I think she's grown stronger from it. And she's been able to prove to herself that she can do these hard things.
You know, it's interesting, dude, as you're talking, I have this theory, and I, in some weird way, think that I would be successful at this because I believe in it so much. But, and that's the sale of life insurance. I think it's wild that people have children and aren't carrying a significant policy, being what it costs to carry like a whole or a term life policy of like $45-$50 a month for like $1 million in life insurance, especially in this profession. I don't have anybody to sales pitch you to. I'm just saying, it's wild to me that people won't spend $1.50 a day to make sure that if something happens to them, at least financially, their family's going to be in a lot better place with $1 million, or at least $500,000. You know, probably $23 a month to carry $500,000 life insurance policy. And police officers don't even have them. They have kids. So did you carry a life insurance policy prior to this?
Yeah. Yeah. I did. I have like $900K on me. And but I maxed out my department, and then I have a separate one on the side. So,
and you know, that only goes like, look, I get it. It's better than nothing, but you're talking about having little children. 900K is not going, it's definitely better than nothing, but it's not going super far. It's not, you know, I mean, I carry a significant life insurance policy because I told somebody, I was actually out with Kenny Williams, who's one of our instructors. We were out Saturday night, and I said to him, you know, cause I asked him about his policy. He said, yeah, I carry a policy. So does his wife. And I said, yeah, I carry this much. And he goes, that's a lot. I go, well, you know, Ken, I got to be honest with you. As a dad, the worst news that you could probably receive is that you're going to be dying. But at least I'd have some comfort knowing that they're going to be okay if that's the case.
Right.
At least financially, right? I would really appreciate it if I get an opportunity to raise my children and be in their life until they're significantly older and be able to pass along the things that I've learned. And I would even argue breaking the cycle or the environment of what we've been used to. So, you know, in a socio or society type of way. So for example, is the things that I had to learn on my own to raise us into a different level of thinking. I'm looking to pass that along to my children rather than somebody who is not progressed like we have progressed in some sense, quote unquote, and has no context of what it means to be like compassionate, empathetic, non-judgmental, successful, hardworking. Those are not things that I found when I was growing up in lower middle class suburbia. That's not what people thought. People, I got a job, I work at a factory, I make this much money, we clip coupons, we do this, that's all we can do. 40 hours a week, the rest of the time I'm drinking and fucking off. All that stuff is one thing that I hope that they can you know, that they can get from me because it's such a valuable gift. But again, the other side of it is this idea that at least financially they're going to be okay. They'll continue on with their life status quo. But I'm glad that you actually carry some a carry policy. And, you know, especially if you have children, I mean, I think everybody should at least carry $1 million.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree. And I always joked, I'm like, well, you'd be able to, you know, take care of this, this and that. And whoever you marry next would be able to live off of those, you know, off of my death money. So have fun with it.
I don't know if 900,000 is that much money to live off of. We're talking about a lifetime, right? In today's modern. Yeah. But I'm saying, like, what are you going to, like, okay, you pay off the house. I mean, we're in Jersey. It's a little different, right? But like, if you're talking about a conservative interest rate, in some sense, you're talking about 6% conservative interest rate. And I know we're getting off the beaten path here a little bit, but essentially on 900,000, you're talking about your wife's gonna be able to make about $55,000 a year.
Yeah.
I don't know if that'll fly very far in Utah. In New Jersey, no, that makes you probably the poorest motherfucker here.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's why I carry a policy, because the plan for me is if something does happen, she can take that money, invest it conservatively, anticipate about a 6% return and continue life as the status quo. Probably not going to be as good as if I was around making life financially better, but certainly not going to disrupt how my family lives at the moment for that kind of. Yeah, so that's the idea. So there's a lot of thoughts. And I say this because I feel like part of this podcast is us to provide value to the community so they can hear this and go, okay, I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah.
Right. That's why I'm saying it's important to know these things. But anyway, let's continue on.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, she didn't want me to go to West Valley, but I took the job anyways, and she wasn't very happy with me. And I don't know. I just felt like, West Valley is just what I wanted to do. I won't, you know, go where the action is, you know, and, you know, I say that, you know, like it's an LAPD, but in reality, it's nothing like that, obviously. But we have like 220 sworn, you know, officers. So it's not terribly big, but it's not small. I think I want to say we're like the third largest in the state, department wise, somewhere around there. We're the second largest city. So I started there 2016. And then, when I came back in 2018, after that little 6 month, stop, I shouldn't say stop, but anyways, when I came back, we had a unit called the Street Crimes Unit, and they do everything from narcotics to fugitive task force to long-term drug investigation type stuff, that kind of stuff, all stolen vehicles. They're the proactive guys, the plain clothes, you know, unmarks, all that kind of stuff. And that's really what my interest was in, was given my dad's background and, you know, why I wanted to be a cop. I really wanted to get into that unit. And so I did my best to be proactive on patrol, and kind of show my worth, if you will. And in 2019, at the end of 2019 in December, I got, the call, our deputy chief called and said, hey, there's a spot open and we want you to take it. And I was like, great. And he said, it starts at the next, bid. For the patrol bid in a couple of weeks. And I said, awesome, sounds good. So my last shift on patrol, I end up finding a stolen that was parked at a gas station, just at a pump. And I end up dry spiking it, just, you know, trying to avoid it if it fled. You know, we had spikes under it. And I end up tearing my ACL on that. I took a bad step, blew out my knee. And, I was kind of in this like limbo, like he was supposed to come over, but we don't know what to do with him since he's on light duty now. And I had previously torn my ACL like 5 years before that. And so I ended up having to have a couple surgeries, before I could get my ACL replaced because just how my knee was. So I ended up being on light duty for about 15 months. And, so I wrote a desk. I was still in their unit, but I screened all their cases, helped with warrants here and there, that kind of stuff. Just kind of sat back and just tried to learn. So then in May 1st of 21, I got off light duty and I was excited. I was ready to go. And I just hit the ground running with the unit. And we had a good summer. We were really active and really productive. And so the unit was, we were also cross assigned with the U.S. Marshals VFAS team. We went out and just got the fugitives. And so we were doing a lot of that. And in November, we went to CNOA, the California Narcotics Officers Association, their big, seminar, and it was in Reno, Nevada. So, we felt like we had a good break, well-deserved, little break there. And we had a good time as a unit down there in Reno. And, it was right before Thanksgiving. So we came back, had Thanksgiving, and then rolled right into the next week. We were doing we were going to do an op with a multi-agency op. So the plan was, the State Bureau and along with, the ATF task force officers, they were out looking for, a bunch of these gang members. And for you, I think I'm probably going to say it wrong, like the 220 block bloods or the something block bloods. I can't remember the name of the gang off the top of my head. They were all wanted for various, firearm charges, and some other stuff. One of their members, Anai Joker was his name. He was a 20-year-old kid, who 4 years previously had gotten into a shooting with police, a 16-year-old, and got shot in the ass. He didn't do much time for that, or he was still bouncing, waiting for his trial and all that stuff, for a while since he was a juvenile. He ended up getting convicted, but then the judge let him out early. He wrote some pity letter that he had changed. He was a different person, and the judge lets him out early. Well, I'm trying to remember the time frame on when he was let out early, but he'd been out for like 6 or 7 months, something like that, prior to this incident. So what happened with Joker is that we were looking for him specifically because he was wanted for questioning for a rape of a child in our city. So our SVU, our sex crimes detectives, were like, hey, you guys are going after this gang. Well, one of their gang members, Anai Joker, is wanted for, we need to talk to him about this rape that he's a suspect in. So we need you to bring him in when you pick him up. We're like, all right. Well, earlier that morning, it was either the night before or that morning, he went and did a drive-by at that victim's house. So he went and shot up that house where the victim lived. So we're like, all right, well, we know from his previous history that he's armed. He's typically armed, and we're getting information that he just shot up her house. So he's, likely armed even more so. So it was December 1st. We started our shift a little bit later because the op was going till like 4 to 2 a.m. So I'm leaving for the day, and my wife says, so what do you guys have planned today? And I tell her, oh, yeah, we're doing this and that. And she goes, okay, well, be safe. And I not even joking, and I may have like cursed myself, but I said, honestly, babe, wouldn't it be the worst if I took one in the leg or in the chest, in my vest?
Oh, that's fucking weird.
So, and I laughed, right? Cause we're sick, demented people. And I laugh, and she's like, that's not funny. You shouldn't joke about that. And I said, it's all right. I'll be fine. And I said, love you. Bye. And fast forward. So we're looking for him, and he had taken this victim's phone, and she turned on the, Find My Phone app. So we started tracking, where the phone was. And so it's going here, it's going there. So we start getting the area, and we end up locating a car that we believe the phone's in, but we don't know if who's in the car yet. So we follow it for a little bit, and we end up like getting the helicopter in the air just in case it flees, all this stuff. So we're just getting an arrest plan put together for a bunch of just in cases. So it turns into a gas station, a 7-Eleven gas station on 4100 South and Redwood Road right there, just on the border of our city and another. And we still don't know if he's in the car or not. And so we're still waiting. We're watching it. And lo and behold, he jumps out of the passenger seat and he like adjusts his pants and he's like looking around and then he just jumps back in. And so we've got confirmation that he's in the car. And when they had stopped, two females exited the car, the driver and a passenger in the back, and they went into the convenience store. So the plan was, when they exited the store, we were going to box the car in and we were going to call him out. And we're just going to clear the car. So they start to come out of the car. Everyone moves in, they get the car they get the car boxed in, and a couple of the cars come up to the on the, so they're facing north south or south, yeah, north south. We just come in on, I come in on the passenger side, and there was one of the State Bureau guys pulled in his unmarked about 10-ish 15 feet away, and we use that as cover. We're calling him out. He's not listening to us. He refusing. Another guy comes out of the back. He comes out. He's like, dude, I have nothing to do with this. I'm out. And he says, by the way, there's a baby in the car. And we're like, what? He said, yeah, there's a baby in the back seat. And that's when I start looking around and I can hear the lady yelling, my baby's in there. My baby's in there. So we're like, okay. So we're trying to use that to our advantage, you know, hey, come out, don't let anything happen to the baby. We're trying to everything we can to just get him out of the car. He's refusing, refusing, refusing. So with that information, we move up and we get a shield. I take shield cover and we get an immediate action team set up just in case we need to move in quickly, right? For the baby. So, somebody gets on the phone with him and they're trying to negotiate with him because now, you know, at this point this is several minutes have gone by, 10, 20, 30 minutes, whatever. And still hasn't budged. And it's probably about 50 minutes after the initial contact with him, that he makes a deal that he wants a Bic lighter and he'll exchange the baby for a Bic lighter. So, that's fair trade. Yeah, we'll absolutely do that.
Hey, everybody. I'm Heather Gologlich, instructor here for Street Cop Training for the course, The Complete Female Cop. This class is not just for females. It's not just about gender-specific issues. It was really formed in order to allow people to find that passion again for policing, to understand that their self-identity doesn't need to be changed just because they want to fit the mold, and to really help bring about change. Change in the profession, not just for women, but for everybody, to be heart-led servant leaders. If you're interested in taking the course, you can visit streetcop.com and search Heather Gologlich, and you'll be able to find it. I'm also really excited to announce that I have a new course coming out. It's going to be called Be the Change. Some of the great feedback I got from this year's conference in Nashville was that the men in this profession didn't feel like they wanted to take a spot away from the women that they work with for my first course that I teach. And so I was really able to sit down and put together a course about culture change and building effective teams and learning about a growth mindset versus stagnation mindset, pushing forward and just being the best cop that you can be, both personally and professionally. So really excited for that to be coming out soon. Keep an eye out for it. Thank you all so much. Stay safe and be the change.
He puts the baby in the back, that cargo area. One of the sergeants for the Metro gang unit, he goes up with the shield and they get the baby out. He tosses the lighter in there. And baby comes out, and now it's just, we're dealing with him. So as we're dealing with him, we're still trying to get him to surrender peacefully, come all out. all this stuff. And we have somebody checking his social media as this is going on, because we can see he's on the phone. The windows are really tinted, so we can't see what he's doing, but we can see that he's on the phone a lot. And what he was doing was he was posting a bunch of stuff, and he was also calling all of his buddies and his friends to come to the area. And so his friends start showing up, and they're being held, you know, they're being stopped across the street. He's saying that he wants to talk. He wants his mom. He'll come out once his mom comes to the scene. And so he just wants his mom there. And they're like, okay, 10 more minutes, 10 more minutes. And they keep giving him 10 more minutes. And then we get word that he just posted on, I want to say Snapchat, a picture of his gun. And you can see the red and blue lights, and it says shootout.
Wow.
So we go, okay, this, like, he's either legit or he's just trying to get some credit, right? So as more and more of his friends showed up and family members, and I should, let me back step just a bit here. When we were trying to locate him initially, his brother, who we had dealt with plenty of times beforehand, had just gotten out of federal prison and was on federal probation. And we went to his place like 3 hours before this went down, and we're talking to him saying, hey, help us contact Joker. Tell him to come in. Tell him to meet with us. We can do it the safe way. We'll do it so that nothing happens. We promise you his safety, all this stuff. And his brother pretty much just told us to pound sand, said he's an adult. He can deal with it on his own. We're like, okay, but we're going to find him tonight. And he said, good luck. So fast forward, his brother's now at the scene screaming, you know, at us and all this stuff. And so meanwhile, I'm still in that stick, still on shield cover. And I'm probably, yeah, maybe 12, 15 feet away from the passenger side of the car. So because he had family and friends coming, showing up, our incident commander, my lieutenant, made the decision to pepperball the car. And because we had that back tailgate open, we're trying to entice him out, trying to just get him out of the car. So we do, or one of the guys in my unit, he does, he pepperballs the car, and the car starts kind of shaking, you know, like he's moving around a lot. And I hear someone yell, gun, gun, gun. I can't see it. The windows are, our windows are tinted. The passenger side window is really tinted. The other people on the other side of the car I was on, they could see through the windshield. And I remember yelling where, when they said gun, 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 because I couldn't see anything. And then the door opens up. And as the door opens, he kind of pops out, and the first thing I see is a magazine, an extended magazine, and him holding the gun, handgun. I look as I put my guns on him. We make eye contact, like we looked right each other in the eye, and he had the only way I can describe it is it was just evil in his eyes. Like the way he snarled his mouth when he looked at me, that was it. And this all happened, you know, within less than a second, right? Right when I saw the gun and I looked at him, I squeezed off rounds. I started squeezing off rounds. And then everybody else, the volley occurred. There was 11 shooters total. He was hit anywhere between 25 and 40 times, something like that. But what happened was, as I'm squeezing off rounds, he starts to go down, and as he's going down, he starts to fire, just instinct, like just, he's just spraying, praying, right? Type of thing. Two of those rounds that he got off, one skipped off the pavement, and hit my right, my left leg about between about halfway between my knee and my ankle. And the next round went up just above my vest. I had an outer carry vest, and actually I just got it back. I just got the stuff back last month, and I was looking at it to see where it missed. And I have a picture, the fabric lining, there's that little like quarter inch of fabric lining that goes around your vest, the actual ballistic. And it hit that fabric lining probably about less than an eighth of an inch above my actual vest. So it missed me by literally, like an eighth of an inch, missed that vest. So what happens, it struck right up here, right where my thumb's pointing, and it ripped through. It was a through and through, and it punched into the back of the inner plate on the back of my ballistic vest. And when it hit my leg, I thought immediately, I ran into like the hitch of a car, of like a pickup truck, like I was at full sprint. And I ran into have you ever done that where you're like, you smack your shin on the hitch of a pickup?
Well, it's funny. You're asking a guy from New Jersey. Like we have a profound amount of pickup trucks riding around. Like we're going, it's a little different out here, but yes, I know what you're talking about. Just whacking my knee on shit. No question about your shin. Yeah.
Take a sledgehammer, 10 pound and have somebody swing it really hard and hit your shin. That's kind of what it felt like.
Wow.
And I was like, when it hit me, I remember everything was slowed down. Like everyone always says, everything kind of slowed down. I say this, like, it's kind of cliche because you hear these stories and you're like, they say, I could see the bullets. You know, I couldn't see the bullets that hit me because if I would have tried to dodge them like the Matrix, but I watched the bullets that I fired hit Joker, hit that guy. And then right when I got hit is when it kind of all, everything kind of snapped back. And it hit my leg and my body kind of shifted down to the left. And then almost immediately after it hit my chest and I stumbled backwards and I yelled out, "Hey, I'm hit. I'm hit. I'm hit." And I kind of went back and I tried to sit down. I don't know where I was going to sit down. I thought like there was an imaginary chair right where I was about to sit down. And then I just fell on my ass. And the guys immediately grabbed me and they dragged me back. And they dragged me probably 75 feet away. And this is December in Utah. It's cold. And I don't blame them for this, but they dragged me through a puddle. So I was like soaked, and I remember being like, "Did you seriously drag me through water?" And so I lay down there. I'm laying there in the parking lot of the back parking lot of a Little Caesars that was just to the south of the 7-Eleven, and I feel my body just it is freaking out, and I'm trying to stay calm, trying to just breathe, relax. I trust the guys that I'm with. I trust that fire and EMS they were on standby. So I trust that they're close. And I'm just thinking to myself, this is just a through and through. You're okay. You're going to be fine. I can't move my left arm whatsoever. And in fact, when I got hit up in my chest, when it got hit, my arm immediately went dead and I dropped my gun. I could not move my arm for anything. Like it just wouldn't move at all. I was trying to move it, but it was just dead. And so I'm laying there and I have a bunch of people surrounding me yelling, everything's just chaos. And a couple of the guys in my unit, one of them, he comes up, he grabs my right hand. He's like, "Hey," and he's yelling at me, "Riley, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake." And I'm looking at him like, I'm awake, like, stop yelling at me. And then he starts smacking me and he's like, "Don't you close your eyes." And I'm telling him, I'm like, "I'm not closing my eyes. Quit hitting me." One of the guys there, he'd run up there. Like when they laid me down, I told him, I was like, "Hey, left, I thought it was my shoulder at the time. I said, left shoulder, left leg, left shoulder, left leg. So they start, you know, tearing my stuff off, trying to get to me. And somebody runs in to give me, to throw the tourniquet on. And when he did, he came in and kneed me right in the crotch. Like he right in the crotch. And I remember kind of like lurching up like, oh my gosh. So, and I was looking, I'm like, why did you just do that? And I can see that he's putting a tourniquet on my leg. And I was like, oh man, this is just getting worse and worse. So as all these guys are yelling out and doing stuff, one of the guys, he was Taylorsville is a city just to the south of us. And they had some guys on the off that night. And it just so happens that one of the guys, I'll just say his first name, Marty, he had started his career as an officer. He was in the Army. He was like a Green Beret medic, and then he became a cop, but he stayed in the reserves. And then he actually started in West Valley, and then he got out, went back active, finished out his career in the Army. And then he came back to, he wanted to finish out his career as a police officer. And he had been doing it for a few years in a different city. And then he came down to Taylorsville. It was his second day with Taylorsville. And I personally believe that he was there for a reason. Marty knew, he had worked with, he was a combat vet. He was a combat medic vet. You know, he'd been around a lot of stuff. He knew right when they got my vest carrier off and the pressure from that had been relieved, I started spurting the blood. And he recognized that it was an arterial bleed. And so what happened is the bullet went through my brachial artery. And like I said, I thought it was just like a through and through, and that the movies were just a bunch of full of shit. Cause I was like, these guys get shot in the shoulder all the time and they just keep fighting. I was like, that's a bunch of BS. That's not what happens. And I'm thinking these things as it's going on. And then when they, and I'm kind of just trying to low key it as much as I can. And as when they take that off and I hear, hey, we need a chest wound or a chest seal. We need some chest seals. I don't know what it was, but I knew chest seals were bad. And so I immediately, that's when my stomach kind of sank. And I said, oh, this is a lot worse than I think it is. And it was probably about this time that like, I had started losing a lot of blood, and I started to, my body started to just, it was just freaking out. And I remember, thinking to myself, is this it? Is this how it's going to go out? Is this how I'm going to go out? I'm going to bleed out right here. And, somebody was yelling, hey, we got an arterial bleed. And that's when I was like, this is really, really bad. And so I'm looking at, my buddy in my unit, and I'm telling him, hey, tell Kelsey, my wife, tell Kelsey, I'm sorry. Tell her that I love her. Tell my family I love them. And he was just like, stop saying that stuff. And I was like, no. He's like, you're going to be okay. It's just a flesh wound. You're going to be okay. And I was like, no, this is important. I need you to tell him that. Okay. Just in case. And, he's kept telling me, you're going to be good. You're going to be good. The best way, I don't know how else to describe it, but I could feel the life draining from my body physically. I could physically feel my life leaving. And that was a really scary thought or a scary feeling. It scared me for a number of reasons. One, obviously I didn't want to die. Two, my kids, I couldn't think, I didn't want to have the thought of them being raised without me or by someone else, you know, years later or whatever the case was. I just, especially, you know, how young they were. And it just was killing me to think like that. And obviously Kelsey leaving her behind. And, it was a really scary thought. And then I had to snap out of it, and I had to just control my breathing and, fight through that fight through those thoughts, fight through those, fight through the pain, and just stay conscious as best I could. And fire got there probably a minute or so after, and they started doing their work and they got me on the gurney. So I'm in the ambulance, and another one of the officers in my unit, she jumps in with me, and she says, she's like, I'm going to ride with you. And I asked her, I was like, okay, I need you to call Kels. I need you to call Kelsey. And she's like, all right. So she calls her, and she's just like, hey, Kelsey, it's Karina. Just let you know, Riley's been in an accident. And I was like, no. Give me the phone. Put it on speaker. She's going to freak out if you say something like that. Just give me the phone. And so she puts it on speaker. She puts it on my chest right here. I go, hey, babe. And she goes, what's going on? This is at 10:30, 10:45 at night. And she's like, what's going on? Are you okay? And I go, well, kind of. I've been shot twice. I need you to go to the hospital. I need you to get to IMC like now. I'm okay. I'm still conscious. I'm breathing. But just get to the hospital as soon as you can. Call my mom. Tell her to come sit with the kids. And she's just like, shocked. And I was like, I love you. It's going to be okay. I'll see you when you get there. Not knowing, like in the back of my head, like I wasn't sure 100%. So, like I trusted everyone. I trusted I was going to be okay, but you just never know in those situations. So VFAST or the marshals were out that night doing their thing, and they were around the area. And I mentioned this because Mark, he's the supervisor over that unit. And when he got to the scene, they were in the area. They got to the scene really quick, and he recognized that I was, miles and miles away from the hospital, probably, I don't know, four or five miles. Doesn't seem like a lot, but that's a distance in an emergency. So, he had the state of mind to realize, all right, Redwood Road is a main thoroughfare. Like it's a long, long stretch of road that goes from like the top of Salt Lake County all the way down through another county. Anyways, he got everyone to block off the intersections on Redwood. And so the ambulance didn't have to stop. They could just go. And so we got to the hospital really quick. And, that saved probably a minute or give or take of time in that instance. That was a huge thing. So I get to the hospital, they get me in the trauma room, they start doing their thing, bunch of medical people all over the place running, yelling all this different stuff, and they're taking all my clothes off, and I had a drop down holster on my leg, and I'm left-handed, and so my holster was on my left leg. And they had cut my pant leg up all the way to the holster. And they were like, we need to get this off. And they're like, but it was connected to my belt. And they have one of those next belts that clicks, into place. And they were like, they couldn't figure out how to take it off because it wasn't like a buckle. So they're like, just cut, these scissors will cut through it, cut it. And I reached down and I was like, stop, don't cut my belt. That's an expensive belt here. And I remember taking my hand, I unbuckled the belt, or I opened it up so they could take it off. I don't know why I was thinking, it's like, that's an expensive belt, don't cut it at that time. But anyway, so time it's all kind of a blur from there. I do remember right before we got to the hospital, one of the fire guys was like, hey, let's get some fentanyl on board. And I said, yeah, that'd be helpful. They're like, no, we're almost here. They'll just have to get on board when he gets in. And I was like, oh, okay. Thanks, guys. So we get in, or they're doing their thing, and, they hit me with fentanyl, and, didn't really do much. I remember. And in fact, the nurse, I went through like 5 or 6 chest seals on scene, because they would put one on and it would just fill up. They have to rip it off, wipe, and put another one on, rip it off and continue to do that. The nurse gets, when I got in, through all the chaos, the fire guys couldn't brief, or they were briefing someone else. And then one of the nurses comes up and rips that chest seal off and it starts spurting blood everywhere. And I was so cold that my own blood, it was so warm. She stuck her finger in the bullet hole to stop it because she was yelling. She needed some quick clot. And I remember asking her to just let me bleed a little bit more because the blood felt so good because it kept running down my back and my everything. I was like, that feels so good. And then I realized it was my own blood. And and I was like, oh, never mind. Yeah, that's probably a good idea. But when she stuck her finger in that bullet hole, I got to tell that. I mean, I was feeling a lot of pain, but that right there was some pain. Kelsey arrived. We lived like 30 minutes from that hospital, maybe 35. She got there relatively quick. In my mind, she got there quick. I don't know how long it actually took her, but they were just trying to get me stabilized. And she got there. I was able to talk to her for a minute. She could see that I was alive, talking, you know. Again, just told her I loved her and to said tell the kids I love them, make sure they know. And they were wheeling me over to surgery. And then they hit me with ketamine, and that was pretty much it. After that, I do remember feeling, I took that K-train ride. I rode that K-train, as they say, and that was an experience in and of itself. I remember a little bit of it. At one point, my chief was there and I was coming out in and out. And I was like, I love you, chief. I love you so much. I don't know why. It just made me in a really happy mood. And then I got wheeled into surgery, and 6-ish hours later, they were done. And woke up. I remember kind of waking up in recovery and seeing some doctors talking about some stuff, and Kelsey was there, and they were saying that they had to do another surgery, but they might wait. And then I woke up, I don't know, like 10 hours later or something like that, in the ICU and the trauma ICU. So I had somebody, our department assigned someone to come sit with me in the room the whole entire time I was at the hospital. Mainly one, because it was a gang, they were worried about gang retaliation. And they just wanted to make sure that somebody was in there for protection. And two, just to make sure that I had somebody there with me, and an officer there with me to show support and stuff. So, and they mainly picked the guys that, you know, we have a lot of new people in the department. So, there was a lot of the people were the people that I've known for some time. So that was a really cool thing that they did for me. What happened was, so they had to replace my, brachial artery. So they took a vein from my thigh, my right thigh, and they transferred it, up into, gave me a new artery up here. That was that long surgery. And then, the second day or third day I was there, they went and put a rod down my leg, onto the tibia, where the bullet, so the bullet, when it hit my leg, it broke the tibia and fibula, but it shattered on impact. And so they just put a rod in there to let it heal on its own. And so all the bullet that shattered it's still in my leg. I went home like five days later. I was able to go home. And at the time, the hospital still had COVID restrictions. So only two people were allowed per day, to visit. And the guys that came to visit me were like, yeah, screw you, we don't care. So I had a lot of visitors initially. And then after a couple of days, they moved me down just to like regular trauma area or whatever. The freaking head nurse there on that shift was a complete douche canoe. And he came in after I had several visitors. He came in and was like, all right, no more visitors today. You're cut off. I understand that you're going through a lot, but we can't make exceptions just because you're a cop.
Wow, it's fucked up.
Yeah. And I said, wow, okay. And I didn't like, there were, my wife was in the room. So I was like, I'll talk to him later. So I asked him to come back later and talk to him. And we had a conversation, and he walked out on me on that conversation.
What a scumbag. You guys ever report him to the hospital?
I believe my sergeant did. Yeah. Later on. Cause what happened was my family members couldn't come and see me after that. Like, my kids couldn't come regardless because the hospital didn't allow kids, visitors.
What the fuck, dude?
It was ridiculous. And, so I FaceTimed my kids after a couple days. And then like my parents couldn't come and see me because they cut my visitors off. So the only person allowed was my wife. And
that's horrible, dude. Like, you were in fucking prison after getting shot.
Yeah. So I actually asked to leave earlier than they wanted me to leave, because I was done with their stupid, nonsense. It pissed me off so much. I was like, fine, then let me go home. I'm fine. I can walk. I can go home. They're like, no, I don't think you can't go home yet. We still need you here for observation. Blah,
yeah, but they
blah.
Can't make that determination on your behalf. You know what I mean? They can't keep you in the hospital.
No, they just would release me against medical advice.
Right.
That was kind of later in the day when I requested to go home, and they're like, okay, well, let's just get you through the night. Just trust us to get you through let's just take some time, sleep on it. And then if you still feel like you want to go home in the morning, we'll see if you can, walk, if you can go up some stairs. And they're like, we'll get somebody in here to do what your release stuff. And then we'll let you go. And the lady,
you know, that head nurse's name?
Not off the top of my head. No, but,
do you know that head nurse's name?
No, not off the top of my head. No. Mm. I did write a letter. It was a pretty strongly worded letter. Nothing really has come of it yet. But the occupational therapist came in and they're like, all right, let's see if you can go up and down some stairs. And they had this little portable stair thing. And I grabbed a cane and or a crutch and went up and down the stairs. Fortunately, I knew how to work crutches really well because I was on them for so long with my knee. And she was like, yeah, I think if you feel comfortable enough going home, you can. And so I was like, yeah, see ya, bounced. And got home to where I could, see the people that I needed to and start the recovery process from there.
When did you see your kids for the first time?
When I got home.
What was that like?
I told my sergeant, I said, when I go home, I don't want anybody, just come pick me up. Come pick me up. And then, Kelsey's going to take me home. I don't want, cause you see these, like, when cops get released from hospital, like their department's there and there's people there, to show their support and stuff. And I just felt weird about that. And so, I just asked to just do it quietly. And he, doesn't ever listen to me. So he made sure there was people there. And so I got home. And when I got into my neighborhood, Utah is really, really, really pro police. As far as like the majority of the public goes, of course there's, a bunch of, there's the anti PD people here, but, when I got here, my neighborhood had like, the ribbons and the flags and, the FOP auxiliary, the wives, they had gotten together and made like a little, they did all that. They got that all arranged, and I got home and, got out of the car, and it was a really surreal, really cool moment just to see the support that was there. from the community and from those the people who are closest to me and stuff. It was a really cool moment. And then my kids were waiting out there, and just to hug my daughter for the first time was that felt really good. You know, it scared. She was young. She was turning three. I want to say she was just about to turn three. So she didn't really understand everything. But my other two, my boys, they were scared. It scared them. I guess they didn't know what had happened. They just were told that I was in an accident and that I was in the hospital, but that I was okay. And so when I FaceTimed him for the first time, that's when I told him what had happened, hey, dad got shot, bad guy shot me, blah, blah, blah. But I'm okay. So it kind of scared him. So, but it was still, for them to see me in person, I think relieved a lot of that, kind of that scary feeling, and made him realize that, oh, he's still here. He's going to be okay. So
were they crying when they saw you?
The middle, he was kind of just like joking around with me like he does. My oldest, yeah, he was a bit emotional. Cause he realized, I think he recognized the moment and stuff. So it was nice.
You ever get a chance to thank everybody that helped you that night?
Oh yeah. Yeah. In fact, like a month or so after I got home, I went to the fire department, I went to the station that was dispatched on it. And we had dinner together and we talked about it, and I told them thank you for everything, for saving my life. I had lunch with Marty, and thanked him, and the guys that like were, you know, instrumental. So the surgeon that did my artery, I forget what they're called, vascular surgeon, he told me that when he got the page that there was someone coming in with my injury, he's like, I fully expected to come down and have you coded. He's like, and then working on you, because he's like, you would have lost. He's like, by the time I got the page, he's like, I figured you would have lost, you know, X amount of blood, blah, blah, blah. And that you'd be unconscious. And not only were you not unconscious, you were awake and you were making jokes. He's like, so I was like surprised, because at that point I had lost almost 3 liters of blood. And, so he's like, all right, this guy, seems to be okay. And then he's like, my next worry, well, once that was settled, I didn't really have to worry about that, because they were taking care of it. He's like, the clock started on how fast we could get this surgery done. And if you were going to lose your arm or not. And I was like, and this is in my follow-up appointment with him. I said, I'm sorry, what? And he goes, yeah, we had to make sure we got it under a certain time, because you're without your main flow of blood to your arm, your arm would have died. We only have so much time to fix it. And if you don't, we would have had to just amputate your arm. And I said, like a full amputation? He's like, oh yeah, yeah. It would have been like full, like Def Leppard type amputation. And sorry, Def Leppard drummer amputation. And I was just like, I had no idea. He's like, yeah, but don't worry. We got it. We got it just in time. You're good. Like, he was just like nonchalant about it.
What pain or discomfort do you live with today? And have you returned to work?
Yeah. So we were on admin leave. So sorry, let's see. 4 of us in my unit, we shot. So we were all on admin leave, and our admin leave is, for our department, it's a little bit different. Like, we hear these other departments throughout the country, like they're like, you know, 2 weeks, a week, a couple days, you know, whatever. Our district attorney he's not very pro police. So our chief likes to keep our guys on admin leave until the case is presented to the DA's office. And then after that, they have a good idea of like kind of the direction the DA is going to go. And so with that information, then they say, okay, we'll get you off. You guys can come back. So we were on admin leave in, through March, I want to say. And then the chief felt comfortable saying, okay, you guys can come back.
So physically, you returned to work. You when did you get cleared physically to go back to work?
I still haven't.
Okay, so you're not back on full duty.
Not on full duty. So several months after I came back from admin leave, I went to, they transferred me over to the training unit. So I've been in the training unit since last October, I want to say. And I'm just kind of hiding out there, working with those guys out there. So what happened is the bullet hit it's called a nerve trunk. So the artery and the nerve trunk run together and it sliced through the bottom of that nerve trunk, permanently damaging it's been so long since I've told someone, anyways, it's the nerve that controls half of my hand. And so being left-handed, it's put me in, you know, kind of a bad spot. So currently, my fingers don't move past that. Like I can move these mm-hmm. three, but these are stuck down. I can move them manually by myself. Like, if I like stretch them, they'll move out, but then they just curl up back into this position. Last August, I had a surgery where they transferred a nerve. So they transferred the good nerves over to the dead one. And that one's growing along the dead one. And it's supposed to regain my functionality and give me back my sensation and feeling, all of that stuff, so that I can get back, hopefully return. Now, the doc said that it won't be 100% ever again, but he hopes that it will get to a point where I can handle a firearm, you know, smoothly, correctly, and that I can continue to be a cop. I asked him what the chances are of me being a cop are. Like, hey, what do you think? Will I still be able to be a cop ever? And at the very beginning, he's like, I don't know. He's like, it's just too hard to tell. That was almost a year ago. And in fact, they call it a CMJ or an EMJ. It's a nerve conduction test. I have that tomorrow. They're going to go in, they're going to test the nerve to see where it's grown, how well it's doing, where it's stopped growing, etc. And then I follow up with him on this Thursday. And this Thursday, I'm going to have a lot of answers on my career. It's going to tell me if I can continue a career or not, essentially, back on the road.
The last thing I have, because I do have to run, is one message to all police officers after going through the event and ordeal that you went through. And maybe it's has to do with how you feel about life now, maybe how you feel about training, maybe your mental state, but one thing you could tell everybody.
The what if game. I think the what if game saved my life, in terms of what if this happens? What if this happens? Constantly playing that what if game. I can't tell you how many times I played that game in my head. What if you get shot? What are you going to do? How are you going to react? What if you're still conscious? What are you going to say? How are you going to say it? Remain calm. I played that out over and over and over again, constantly. You know, and maybe it's not great on the stress level because it maybe puts you in a stressful area. I don't know. But for me, it was detrimental because it kept me calm. It kept me there. It was super important.
I don't think detrimental is the word you were looking for. I think it was beneficial. Detrimental would be a bad thing.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry.
You've been shot, so you get a pass.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
It was extremely beneficial for me. So, and I would just say that the little things, whether you're pissed off at your department because they don't do this or they're doing this, the little things, don't let them get to you. Work through it on your own, like push past it. If there's better departments out there, I've done that. I went to another department thinking the grass was greener. It's not greener. It's just a different shade of green.
I'm going to just jump in here real quick and say this, because this is a touchy subject with me and I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit here. Sometimes people are standing in mud, and even a little blade of grass is better than standing in mud. So I'm a firm believer that if your situation and circumstances are not ideal and have no hope, you know, it's time to maybe go to a different table and play a different game. Put your cards down. So, you know, just a few more pieces of advice, because I'm very strongly opinionated about this. If you leave for more money, that's usually never a good idea. But if you leave for more purpose, and the agency that you're looking at seems to be more aligned with how you saw your law enforcement career, and they have more money, that's just a bonus. That's fantastic. But other than that, I've always heard people who left a great place to go for more money that they regretted that. But I've never heard somebody leave a shitty place. And dude, it's hard to have context of what's shitty and what's not.
Right.
Every place has its own little beefs and problems, but some places are just a complete disaster. And you wouldn't have to go too far. Pick any major U.S. city on the map. Go check out their police departments. And I'm sure that could be the standard of how bad could it possibly get. So if you're there, it's probably pretty fucking bad.
No, and that's what I was going to say is I left thinking it was going to be better for me, because it was at the time, it was more money, and it wasn't. And I came back because it was
the money.
What was best for me. That's right.
Well, dude, this has been a fantastic interview and I appreciate your time. And I want to thank you for taking the time to do this with us. And the value is good, because I think that what if thing was super important. But other than that, man, I appreciate it. I'm glad that you found our group and, you know, you found some people who obviously can relate to what you've been through. And I can't thank you enough for your service. And it means the world to us. And don't think for a second. Don't let this noise penetrate you. I've actually put myself on a complete news diet. I was on a modified news diet, just a modified. Now I'm on a complete news diet and ignoring all the things that are going on. And some people will find that very offensive. But the reality is, mentally, you know, we can get into a place of how bad things are, but it's really amazing to be in a place of how good things are.
Absolutely.
And I don't think you have to look very far beyond the walls of your house to recognize how fortunate we all are. And to live in a country like this, especially coming back from Greece recently, where they're all dying to get to the United States of America, as bad as we may have it. But no matter what the news tells you about who you are, I just want to let you know that I appreciate you a lot for what you've done for all of us. And don't ever take that too lightly. It's a real serious thing. What you did for everybody is nothing short of amazing. You should be very proud of what you're doing.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right, bro. It was nice meeting you.
Okay, you as well. Thanks, guys.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.